3-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
And strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager, that just happened. Thank you very much.
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
All right, here we go. Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast, Gary Hill here. We have a lot to get to in this one, including a marathon in Motown, as the Mariners get an extra inning victory in Detroit to split the series. So we'll dive into that very, very interesting and entertaining ball game. A lot of highlights coming up in just a second. So we'll get to that. Eric Goldsmith had a great conversation with one of the best players this game has seen, Al Kaline. That comes up. A fascinating conversation. If you love the history of the game, you're going to love this conversation with Kaline. That comes up shortly. Shannon Dreher put together a great piece on Franklin Gutierrez, his huge grand slam the other night. That comes up. And also Josh Kearns is back once again. He features the Mariners chef. So that comes up as well. So a lot to get to. And of course, it is Felix Day. Happy Felix Day to all, as the King will take the mound tonight against the Toronto Blue Jays at sold-out Safeco Field with the fireworks going. Weather should be pretty good. It is going to be a fantastic night at the Safe. So happy Felix Day to all. Now, very good ball game going on in Detroit. Mariners and Tigers getting together as the Mariners looking for the split in the series. David Price on the hill, so you knew it would not be easy. Hisashi Wakuma on the mound for the Mariners, so you knew it would be a good pitching matchup. But, surprise, surprise, Kyle Seager wasting no time in the first inning, taking another lefty deep.
The windup and the pitch swung on and hit in the air, deep to right field, down the line, and this one is gone. Goodbye, baseball. Into an entranceway, Kyle Seager jumping on the first pitch to him from Price, and he rides it out of here to right field down the line, his 15th home run of the year.
The Mariners jump out 1-0, and to add to how impressive that was, this nugget from Aaron Goldsmith, Kyle Seager's 20th home run against a lefty since 2013. That's as many as David Ortiz, and only Chris Davis of Baltimore has more in Major League Baseball in that span. He has 27. That is awfully impressive. And to add a little more to that too, Kyle Seager, in terms of Mariners history, is already up there in terms of lefty home runs off of a lefty. He's already fourth in Mariners history. He's got 27. He's looking up at two guys at 33. Remember, he's got 27. Ibañez, Alvin Davis, both with 33. So Seager has six more to get to two of the top three. Now, the problem is, to get to number one, he's going to need 100 more, because Ken Griffey Jr., 127 home runs, lefty versus lefty in a Mariners uniform. So just 100 more to go for Kyle Seager, which is pretty amazing in itself. Seager shouldn't feel bad at all. Griffey, you look at lefty and lefty splits, besides Barry Bonds, I mean, this is going back to the 50s. He's got the most lefty versus lefty home runs in Major League Baseball. So nice company to keep. Seager also batting over 300 against lefties this year, which is very, very impressive. So the Mariners off and running, but a rocky start for Hisashi Iwakuma, and Detroit gets two runs in the first inning. It looked like it could have been a lot worse. It looked like they could have put a few more on the board. But after really the first three batters of the ball game, Iwakuma settled in, and he was great.
Next offer in a swing and a miss by Ghost for strike three. Another strikeout for Hisashi Iwakuma, his third of the ball game, and it's 1-2-3 go the Tigers here in their half of the second.
So he settled in. He was starting to hang zeros on the board, but Price was matching him. It was all zeros on the board. The Mariners were up 1-0. Then Detroit puts two up. So it's 2-1 as we head to the seventh inning. That's when Mark Trumbo comes up big.
And the payoff pitch to Trumbo, swinging a slicer right field, dropping. J.D. Martinez can't play it. He overran. He came too far in. It's past his heels all the way back to the warning track in right field. Trumbo into second, makes the turn, and he stands up at third base. And we are all tied up as J.D. Martinez badly misplayed that slicing line drive to right field off the bat of Mark Trumbo.
And then in the bottom of the frame, Iwakuma finishes off a nice outing by getting a DP.
The 1-1, swinging a ground ball right back to Iwakuma. He throws on to Taylor, covering second, on to first base in time. Anthony goes, lines into a 1-6-3 double play as the Tigers had the go-ahead run at second base, and self-defense classes paying off for Iwakuma. He makes the stab, the turn, the toss, and that's all she wrote for the Tigers in the seventh.
Seven strong for Iwakuma, just two earned runs against a pretty fierce offense, a couple of walks, and a season-high seven punch-outs. Also 112 pitches thrown by Iwakuma. Sensational. Great outing, just what the Mariners needed to match David Price. Price would go eight, give up two earned runs. So the bullpen would come on. But one of the constant themes in this one for the Mariners was their defense.
The pitch on the way, swing and a fly ball, deep left field, going back Gutierrez to the warning track near the wall, leaps up and he makes the catch. Right near the top of the wall, down the left field line, Franklin Gutierrez was running out of room. Ian Kinsler flying out to deep left field, but Goody got back to the wall in time, got to the top of that fence, and he made the catch, one out for the Tigers.
Helping out Mark Lowe, who pitched two scoreless innings once again, striking out four, including both Martinez.
The 0-2 pitch to J.D. Martinez. It is strike three called, and he got him looking. Holy smokes, a double Martinez strikeout for Mark Lowe. He strikes out Victor Martinez. He strikes out J.D. Martinez, and that will retire the side, and the Tigers leave the go-ahead run stranded at second base.
So Lowe pitches two scoreless. Carson Smith, a scoreless inning. Fernando Rodney, a scoreless inning as well. And that's when the Mariners would break through. Mike Zunino was on for Sucre, who was lifted for a pinch hitter. So Mike Zunino in the ballgame. Before he comes up big at the plate, though, a tremendous play defensively in the 10th inning.
Here comes the pitch. Low and outside. It's picked there by Zunino, but there goes Ghost down to second base. The throw, the tag, and they got him. Ghost is out at second base. Zunino tracked the ball nearly outside of the hitter's circle, pretty close to that, and he threw a dart to Cano with the tag on Ghost as Cano holds onto it like a snow cone.
Then he comes to the plate in the 12th inning and delivers big time.
Here's a 2-2. Swinging a line drive left field. It's a base hit tight to the line. A fair ball. Taylor to second. He turns into third. The ball bounces around in left field. Cespedes picks it up. Taylor all the way in from first base. He scores. He's in there on his feet as into second base. There is Zunino. And the Mariners have taken the lead here in the 12th inning.
They take the lead in the 12th, and Tom Wilhelmsen back in a familiar spot, trying to close it out and lock down his first save in a while.
Wilhelmsen's pitch, swinging a ground ball right there to Taylor. The shortstop scoops the underhand, flips to Cano for the force, and that'll be all she wrote here today. Rodney the win. Wilhelmsen his first save since last June, and the Mariners win today in Detroit in 12 innings.
A big win in 12. The Mariners split the series and come home tonight with Felix on the hill. Before we get to that, let's hear from Mike Zunino and his big, big night coming off the bench.
I mean, it's nice to even have that opportunity to get in there, and it shouldn't go unsaid about how Iwakuma and Sucre did today. I mean, I thought they did a good job. It was a good offense and keeping them, you mean, down for the most part. And it was just nice to be able to get in that game and come on the winning end.
How did you get to that
loop? The one I picked?
Yeah.
Close my eyes and hopefully it goes in. And I knew he was an aggressive runner, so I mean, that ball was outside my body. The only thing I could do was try to glove it. And at that point, it was trying to find out where he was. He had a big secondary, so my initial reaction was the back pick. and he actually was going, so I had to redirect. And I mean, Robbie was there and was able to catch it, put a good tag on him.
Yeah, all the way around. Zunino coming off the bench, coming up big for the Mariners. Kyle Seager, of course, huge in this ball game. The home run early, a couple hits, three straight games with two hits.
A lot of fight, you know, going up against Price is obviously going to be a tough battle, but, you know, we battled hard. Our pitching did a great job today. Everybody coming was awesome. You know, the bullpen was obviously phenomenal. I mean, and you get big hits from Trumbo and Zunino there, so it was really good.
You kind of started things out. Price is not a guy you'd had success against. First pitch, you go after it. What were you looking for? What'd you see there?
Yeah, you know, just trying to be aggressive. You know, I don't think, you know, he's not a guy you want to sit around and, you know, necessarily get deep in counts on, you know, as good as his stuff is. So just trying to be aggressive. If you get something you can handle, try to make a good swing on it.
Hey, you had a good look at Kuma out there. He really settled down after that first inning. What did you see from him?
Yeah, you know, after the was it the first three batters there, he was lights out. I mean, it was phenomenal. It was typical Kuma. You know, he was getting some strikeouts. He was getting his ground balls. You know, he had a pretty good tempo going out there. He was awesome.
He was certainly awesome. He was fantastic. Seager, fantastic as well. And so was Mark Lowe, adding nice perspective to things after the ball game.
Go home and hopefully do some work on this next homestand.
You come in, it's a close game. Do you have a good idea it might be two innings for you today?
I mean, when I came in, you know, right away, you know, Mac didn't really give me time to think about it, if it was going to be one or two. Just asked me how I felt. Felt really good. Feeling good all year. I could have gone out for a third if he needed it. Fortunately, you know, it was kind of efficient innings, 24 pitches in two innings. So I've thrown one inning and thrown 24 pitches before. So nice to get two innings and efficient pitches in.
Big situations, obviously, in a tie game. Victor Martinez, you've got him. You're throwing the sliders. You go back to the fastball for the strikeout there.
Yeah, I was 2-2 on him, and he looked really bad on my slider prior to that fastball. And, you know, Matt came out and asked me what I was thinking. And, you know, I said, I'm thinking another slider here. And he said, you know what? I like the fastball up and in a little bit right here. And if he hits it, it's on me. So before I tilled the rubber, I convinced myself that's the right pitch to throw, and 100% conviction, and threw it. And I went and told him afterwards, hey, nice call there. You know, great pitch.
What does that do for you in that situation?
You know what? That's the perfect mound visit for me. If he feels a certain way about a pitch, just to let me know, you know, and I'm on board. I call, you know, I'll shake until I get the pitch that I want to throw every single time. And if I have a manager coming out telling me, you know, this is the right pitch here, let's go with it.
And save a slider for the other Martinez.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's a tough lineup. I mean, it's, you're not able to throw your off speed over. It's a tough lineup. Yeah. Just to battle with your fastball. Got to tip your hat to those guys. It's a great hitting team. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have to play them anymore in regular season. And but we have our work cut out for us with Toronto coming in. And, you know, stay the course. Hopefully get on a roll here.
You guys kind of needed this one, it looked like.
We did. You know, you can only go so long with winning one, losing one, winning two, losing two. And from my experience, this is kind of the kind of things you need to happen to get rolling. And feeling good about yourself on a flight home, and come in tomorrow with a little extra energy and see what happens.
There it is, Mark Lowe. I love the conversation about the mound visit. That is fantastic. A little insight. And Lloyd McClendon, I feel pretty strongly about the fastball. Okay, Skip, bam. And there it goes, and that's the inning. Nice job by Lowe. Great stuff there. So the Mariners get the win over the Tigers. They split the series. Now Felix Day tonight. It was supposed to be Felix against R.A. Dickey, but it was kind of a wild game. Toronto and Oakland day game yesterday. So Toronto was going to throw Hutchinson yesterday, but he has the flu, so Dickey moved up today. Hutchinson, as long as he's healthy, is supposed to pitch tonight. I guess we'll see for sure around game time. But he's supposed to pitch tonight, so pushed back another day, dealing with the flu. He was scratched. He was supposed to pitch against Scott Kazmir of the A's. Of course, he was traded to the Astros. He was scratched as well. So both starters scratched in Oakland. Toronto ended up winning the ballgame behind R.A. Dickey. So no Dickey tonight. But it's going to be Hutchison. So Felix will take the hill, 11-5, 2.77 ERA, 7.10. First pitch from Safeco Field. It's going to be a fun one. Fireworks night, Felix night, a great night at Safeco Field. Remember, 1 o'clock on Saturday, 1.10 first pitch. So day baseball on Saturday, Jay Happ against Marco Estrada, who's pitched really well as of late. And then on Sunday, very intrigued by this matchup. Taijuan Walker looks to bounce back after a couple tough starts. 1.10 first pitch against the ageless Mark Burley, who has been absolutely rolling. 11-5, 3.23 ERA. It's going to be a tough series. Toronto, a game above 500. They are poised right now. They're in pretty good position in the East, and they have a great shot to take things. They're pretty fierce in the middle of the order with Bautista, who's dealing with a shoulder a little bit, but still productive. Encarnacion, who's providing a lot of pop, not hitting for a lot of average, but still dangerous. Donaldson's having a nice year as well. So they are really tough to deal with. Osuna at the back end of the bullpen has helped straighten things out a little bit. They've really struggled for the most part in the back end of the bullpen this season, but once he was inserted into the closer's role, they've been better back there. So it's going to be a tough team for the Mariners to deal with. The Mariners, one thing that I think is pretty interesting coming into this series, the M's in July, the sixth most runs scored in Major League Baseball with 82 runs so far. But as the schedule would have it, a lot of their opponents right there in the top six with them. You have the Tigers, they've scored the most runs in July, 102. You've got the Angels right there, who the Mariners saw right before the All-Star break. They've scored 100 in July. The Brewers, the only NL team at 97. You have the Royals at 96. The Blue Jays at 89. And then the Mariners with 82. So that's the month of July. M's, well, they'll have to pitch well in this series. But they've been scoring runs, and that's been a good thing to see. So Felix on the hill tonight should be a lot of fun from Safeco Field. Right now, we're going to hand things over to Shannon Dreher. Nice piece on Franklin Gutierrez, his big night the other night with the Grand Salami.
Shannon Dreher here at Comerica Park, where moments don't get much sweeter than this.
Here's the set. And the 1-1 on the way, swing and a fly ball into right field and deep. Martinez going back. Goodbye, baseball! Grandma, get out the rye bread and mustard! It is Grand Salami time! Holy smokes! Franklin Gutierrez with a pinch hit grand slam here in the top of the eighth inning. And the Mariners now lead by a score of 11-8. Can you believe it? Franklin Gutierrez with a pinch hit home run here in the top of the eighth inning. And for Goody, his second home run of the year.
Felix Hernandez had a front row seat for the fireworks.
I was at the bench. I was talking to Yoshi for real. And he's like, Yoshi, you're here double. Woody? Yeah, maybe. And then I get up and then boom, homer. And I'm happy for him.
Just the second pinch hit grand slam in Mariners history, and it couldn't have come at a better time, according to Mike Zanino.
Oh, it's awesome. I mean, obviously when you put up four runs in the first inning and one run come off the board, another run not come off the board, and they put up that big inning and then you're down, sort of takes the wind out of the sails. But, we were able to get some guys on, and, Goody came up with another big swing, and, he's just such a great hitter and, very even keel. So, you really like him in that spot.
Gutierrez had been preparing for the possibility of pinch hitting since the fifth inning. When he connected against Neftali Feliz, who he had never had a hit against, he knew he got it all.
It was an amazing moment because I knew that he doubled pretty good. As soon as I saw the right field not moving at all, so I knew the ball was out. So, it was a pretty exciting moment just to score some runs there and help the team score some runs.
Gutierrez may have sounded calm and collected on the field, but make no mistake, there was a raucous celebration in the dugout, according to Felix.
He was so happy, man. It was like, he called me Shaq Cordero all the time. And then, so they see me, I was waiting at the end of the dugout to give him a holler. He said, you see that, Jack? And he was so happy. That was good. That was awesome for us.
And awesome for Gutierrez, who has fought to get back to the big leagues after an illness almost cut his career short. There may be no one in the ballpark who was more thrilled to see this than Felix.
We're really good friends. We consider us brothers. And I know he's been through a lot of stuff. And we talked to him in the offseason. And when he was in, when he decided not to come last year, he was like, he was sad. He was a little down, and then we talked a lot. And then you know, he's trying to rehab everything. And he's always telling me, no, man, I can't do it. I was like, you can do it. Come on, you can do it. Come on, you know I can do it. You're a good player. And look what he's doing this year. I mean, he came back. I know he's been through a lot of stuff. I mean, some days he's hurt, but he's going through. And I'm really happy for him to see him here in the big leagues.
2 years ago, Gutierrez wasn't sure he would be able to continue playing baseball. Last night, he won a game for the Mariners. There's still days where he simply cannot play, and others where it takes a long time and a lot of work to get to the point where he can move well enough to take the field. For him, it is all worth it.
I think it's a bless. I mean, just I'm back on the game again, and you know, in a different role right now. But I'm really happy to be here. I think I have a little more experience now, and just trying to be relaxed at the home play and, you know, let the thing happen.
What's your favorite part of being back right now? It's been such a long road for you.
I think it's just be back with Seattle again. I really love this team, and be back with my friends and you know, all the fans in Seattle. And I'm really, you know, I appreciate all this.
And now Josh Kearns is back with another great piece, this one on the chef of the Seattle Mariners.
After graduating culinary school back in the 90s, Chef Jeremy Bryant formed a catering company with a boyhood friend and fulfilled his lifelong dream of cooking for a living. In his spare time, though, the Seattle native was spending as much time as possible at Mariners games, where a chance meeting would change his life.
I was actually just hanging outside the locker room at the Kingdome, and this kid, Christian Hill, he was a bat boy, or he was a kid from the neighborhood who grew up and became a bat boy. I didn't even know he was working in there.
As they talked, Jeremy learned for the first time that the M's actually had a dedicated cook who prepares food before and after games and begged for a shot to show his chops.
I just kept calling him and coming down and just saying, please let me cook for the team.
The clubhouse manager finally gave him a shot, and Jeremy gave it his all.
My good friend Rod Lane and myself, we came down and we cooked a whole giant spread for the team. And, you know, we brought in an ice carving and we just went all out.
The meal was a hit, and when Safeco Field opened several years later, the clubhouse manager called again and told him to fire up the grill. He's been there ever since. Little did he know, though, what he was actually getting into at the time.
Start my day, start shopping at 8:30, 9 in the morning, and you get here. As you're making the dinner for the post game, you're also making stuff to order as the guys walk in. You know, some guy might want fettuccine, you know, or a guy might want a salad.
Every night, Jeremy and team whip up something special for the post-game feast, from fresh fish to fajitas. The biggest challenge is when the players try and contribute themselves.
And then there's always when Kendrys Morales brought in a whole pig, and he cooked it during the game in his uniform. So what he would do is he would go out and, you know, take his at-bat. And then when he got around the bases or whatever, when he'd get out, he'd come running back here, and me and him would go out in the parking lot and, you know, check on the pig. And
the roast actually turned out to be a roaring success, but others, not so much. Like the time former reliever Norm Charlton tried to impress his teammates with his skills.
He calls me up. He says, hey, Jay, I got dinner, man. Don't worry about it. And I'm thinking, great, because that helps my budget, you know. So I didn't really prepare any dinner because I was thinking, you know, I thought he was going to buy dinner. I didn't know what was going on.
But what Charlton brought most definitely didn't come from a restaurant or a store.
He shows up with these pheasants that he just shot. I mean, they still have feathers and everything on them. And I'm just looking at Norm. I'm like, thanks, Norm. And he's so excited, you know. I'm like, you know, Norm, I'm going to be honest with you, but when I get my chicken, it doesn't have feet and head and feathers. So he starts defeathering this thing right there in the back of my kitchen door, and it just makes a big bloody mess there, you know. And there's feathers everywhere. It's just this huge mess, and he has them on the floor, you know. I mean, this is like health code violation after another. And I start to cut into him, and there's still pellets all inside these birds. And I'm just, I keep seeing myself on the news like, okay, I just, four Mariners choke on pellets or something. So I hopefully Norm doesn't hear this, but I took off to Costco, and I bought a bunch of the rotisserie chickens. And I switched his out.
After the game, Charlton was absolutely beaming with pride about the dinner he thought he brought.
He goes around to all the players and he's like, okay, how was the pheasant tonight? And they're all like, oh man, it's great. You know, and he never had any idea that I was actually switched out for the Costco chicken.
Experiences like that are the ingredients for a lifetime of memories. Plenty of people have encouraged him to write them all down and perhaps share them along with his favorite recipes in a cookbook. There's just one problem, though.
But I would have to call it a guessipy book because I don't measure anything. We usually just turn the music up and we just cook back there. And, you know, guys will be like, hey, can you make it just like you made it yesterday? And I'm in my head, I'm like, I don't even remember what I put in that yesterday, you know, because we're just kind of freestyling everything.
But as they say, if you can't stand the heat, you better get out of the kitchen. After 16 years, Jeremy's more than proven he can take as much as they dish out, even if it means catering to 25 different tastes or more at a time. He'll do whatever it takes to satisfy all those appetites, at least in the locker room. At home, though, that's another story.
I think the last time, I feel bad, I shouldn't even say this on the radio, but I haven't cooked for my wife for probably a couple years. That's sad. I'm going to make her dinner tomorrow.
And finally, we hand it over to Aaron Goldsmith and talks to one of the greatest this game has seen.
Mr. Kaline, you have been with the Tigers since June of 1953. Three, two, one. Mr. Kaline, you have been with the Tigers since June of 1953. I suppose there's a good reason why you were called Mr. Tiger. Your current role with the ball club, you are the special assistant to the president, Dave Dombrowski. Can you tell us a little bit about what your role is right now with the ball club?
Well, first of all, I was in the broadcast booth as an analyst with George Kell for 22 years. And then when my friend Mike Gillies bought the ball club, he asked me if I would move into the front office and help him out and give my opinion on different situations. And then a short period after that, Dave Dombrowski joined the organization. And I've been working with Dave, and I sit in on all the meetings, major league meetings. Of course, I don't know everybody in the other minor leagues for other teams, so I can't really make any comments on those guys. But I sit in on the major league meetings about what our needs are, what we should do, and then I just give my opinion, and then they do what they want with it.
Your career is so vast, it's hard to even know exactly where to start. 22 years, of course, a Hall of Famer. I'd love to talk to you a little bit, Mr. Kaline, about your second full season in the major leagues. 1955, you're the youngest ever batting champion in the history of the game. You're only 20 years old. You hit 340. It was your first All-Star selection of 15 different times for the Midsummer Classic. Let's keep in mind, you're 20 years old at the time. The All-Star roster that year had the names of Nellie Fox, Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford, Red Shane Dienst, Stan the Man Musial, a couple of heroes of yours, Willie Mays, Ernie Banks. You're a kid. What was it like for you at County Stadium for that first All-Star game?
I tell you what, I was so nervous sitting in that locker room with my favorite players. Of course, Ted Williams was one of my favorites, and Mantle was the star at that time in all of baseball. And I wish I were more of a veteran because I wanted to be able to go over and talk to him and maybe get some autographs, have my picture taken with him. But I was so shy and nervous that I just stayed away and just wanted to play the game is all.
It's pretty incredible when you think about where you were that young in your career, and especially when you consider the fact that you went straight from an 18-year-old high schooler to the major leagues, a bonus baby. How difficult was that for you to make that transition?
It was very hard. I joined the team in Philadelphia Athletics at the time, and it was very hard. I was not very welcomed by the players, obviously, because he was an 18-year-old kid out of high school, and I'm taking a veteran player's job. I had to stay in the big leagues for 2 years because I was a bonus player. I got a $15,000 bonus. So I had to stay in the big leagues 2 years. But the players did not want anything to do with me. I was pretty much on my own. I had to find my way around. But the one thing I found out as soon as I put my uniform on, and I could shag balls and fly balls and catch the ball like anybody on our team at that time. I knew I could play the outfield. Now, hitting, different thing, 18-year-olds coming out of high school now facing major league pitchers. So that was something I really had to work on, and I did. But fortunately for me, I was always the guy that put the ball in play, even though it wasn't for power. But not too many guys just went right through me. I mean, I could put the ball in play, and even though it wasn't a hard hit ball all the time, but at least I didn't strike out all the time.
That's a good point. You bring up that All-Star season, that first one we were talking about. You had somewhere around 80 walks and only 50-some strikeouts, and you hit 340. You just don't see numbers like that anymore today. And I'm glad, Mr. Kaline, you brought up the outfield. 10 gold gloves, and people remember your powerful arm and, of course, your ability to cover the field as well. Where did that develop for you over the course of your career, before shagging fly balls maybe?
You know, I could always judge the ball, run the ball down, and always, for whatever reason, I always had a very strong, accurate arm. I may not have had the strongest arm, but I would put my name next to the most accurate thrower that I've ever seen. I always threw the ball. I never threw the ball that far off line like you see today sometimes, balls thrown 20, 30 feet off line. I never threw the ball that far. And every once in a while, I might short hop the catcher or the third baseman and not give him a fair hop. But I was always very accurate, and I took great pride in that. And that's something I don't think major league outfielders do today, take great pride in what they do in the outfield.
And which was more satisfying, maybe a late-inning home run or pegging a runner out at home plate from right field?
Well, they're both equally important. The one thing about making a good play that I might be helping a pitcher save his job. Hitting a home run, that's always great to have a walk-off home run. But I took pride in my outfield because I knew that pitcher out there was trying to fight for a job. And if I could help save a run or get out of an inning, it might help him stay in the big leagues.
I'd love to talk to you a little bit about 1968 and the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. It was an incredible World Series. It went 7 games, and the Cardinals really had the upper hand early in that series. They won 3 of the first 4, and the margin of victory was pretty extreme, it seems like, for each one of those Redbird wins. But bottom of the 7th, game 5, you're at the plate. Tigers are down by a run. A 2-run single from you, which gives the Tigers the lead. The Tigers would go on to win Game 6 and, of course, win Game 7 to win the World Series. Can you take us back to inside the batter's box, what that moment was like for you?
Yeah, well, it was great. I was very happy to be the guy up at the plate because I never was afraid to fail. I always wanted the opportunity. And if I failed, it wasn't because I wasn't trying. But I just wanted the opportunity. And I was in there against Joe Horner, who was a left-handed pitcher, and I knew all about him. I knew that his best pitch was turning the ball over, keeping the ball down and away from a right-hander. And even though it would have been nice to be able to hit a home run, but I knew that my best chance was the base hit up the middle, driving a run. And that's what I tried to do. I anticipated that he was going to try to get me out with his best pitch. And so I looked for his best pitch and was able to get a base hit to right center field to drive in a run. And fortunately for us, we got ahead there and we stayed ahead from there on out.
So now that we've established all this and the fact that you hit nearly 380 in those 7 games in the World Series, a couple of home runs, 8 RBIs, can we talk about game 1?
Yeah, sure.
Bob Gibson turned in an absolutely historic performance. 5 hits. You had one of them, a complete game shutout from another Hall of Famer and a World Series record, 17 strikeouts in an absolutely dominating performance. What do you remember about Bob Gibson in game 1 of the 1968 World Series?
He's the toughest SOB I've ever faced. That's what I'm going to remember about it. But he was just on a dynamite, and I'm glad I didn't have to face him for very much in my career because he was just one of the great guys. He was a mean son of a gun on the mound. He wasn't afraid to brush you back. But for that game, I mean, it was just wonderful, even though he beat us, to see somebody with that much talent and that much desire to be great, and he absolutely was. So, I've got to be very good friends with Bob now that we're in the Hall of Fame, and I always keep saying that, Bob, how come you're always so mean on the mound? You want to knock guys down? He says, well, you know, I don't mind them hitting balls when I throw a pitch inside, but when they lean out over the plate and hit that ball low outside and hits one, that makes me mad, and the next time I face them, I always knock them down.
Was Bob Gibson the most intimidating pitcher that you faced in your 22-year career?
I would say he's up there pretty close to it. I would say he was very intimidating. But Bob always says that, you know, he said, everybody says, I'm staring at him all the time. He said, they didn't realize I couldn't see the signs. So I was staring at the catcher with a mean growl on my face, but I couldn't see the signs from the catcher, and the hitters all thought I was staring at them.
That's incredible. We would never know that. Your 3,000th hit came in your hometown of Baltimore, a double into the corner in right field. What was that moment like for you when you rounded into second base, you stood up, and your parents were there at the ball game, and what was that moment like?
Well, it was great. You know, I had asked our general manager if they wanted me to wait to get it in Detroit, and they said, no, you go out and get it whenever you can because of Roberto Clemente had, got his last one, and unfortunately, he got hit, terrible accident and was killed. So the next best thing was in Baltimore, my hometown. I had certainly my mom and dad and some family members there, and a lot of my high school buddies and stuff were all at the games to watch the game. So if we have a little bit of time, I'll tell you a little story about Dave McNally, who was the pitcher I got the base hit off of. Dave called me in spring training and says, Al, he says that my brother and I are trying to get a Ford dealership in Idaho, someplace where he lived in the off season. Do I know Lee Iacocca? I said, yeah, Lee's a very good friend of mine. He says, he says, we're trying to get a Ford dealership. So anyhow, I called Mr. Iacocca, and I said, Dave McNally. He says, okay, I'll have somebody call Dave. And make a long story short, they were able to get the Ford dealership in the next little town. So Dave calls me. Once the season started, he says, Al, he says, I want to thank you for getting the Ford dealership. And I dreamt that you got your 3,000th hit off of me. Sure enough, in September, I got my base hit off of Dave McNally, who I wore out anyhow because he was left-handed, and I got a double down the right field line.
That's incredible. Do you remember what your first conversation was like with him once it happened? Because that's amazing that he had the premonition that it would happen that way.
No, actually, I never talked to him after that. I mean, he just had called me on the phone and thanked me for helping me get the Ford dealership, and that he dreamt that I would get the base hit off of him. And I had forgot all about it. And then once I got over to the locker room after the game, he called me and says, I told you you were going to. So anyhow, it was very nice of him, yeah.
Now, going back to an earlier comment, that was awfully thoughtful of you to ask the Tigers if they wanted you to wait. Had they had said yes, that they wanted you to wait till the Tigers got back home, do you have any idea what you would have done in the batter's box for however many more at-bats you would have had sitting on 2,099 hits?
Yeah, you know, it was at least four or five games before we would have gotten back to Detroit for, for a chance to get the 3,000 hit. But, again, I don't know what I would have done. I wouldn't have gone to the plate and tried to make it out because there was only one time I was glad to ever make it out in my life, and that was the first time I was called a pinch hit when I was 18 years old. First game in the major leagues, and Freddie Hutchinson, our manager, didn't even know my name. He says, hey, kid, grab a bat. It was the eighth inning, and, of course, I didn't have a bat. It was much too heavy for me, and I pinched it and hit the first pitch to center field for an out, and I was the only time I was ever happy to make an out.
Well, we'll wrap up from going from your first ever major league at-bat to 1980 in Cooperstown, New York, when you're inducted into the Hall of Fame. And two of the first names that you mentioned in your speech were two players that you called inspirations to you to want to be a major leaguer, Ted Williams and Stan the Man Musial. Can you tell us what it was about each one of those players growing up that you admired so much?
Well, Stan Musial was always my all-time, all-around favorite player because he was sort of a guy I try to model myself after, hitting the ball to all fields, able to run a little bit. And of course, Ted was always considered the greatest hitter of all time, and everybody would try to be a hitter like Ted Williams. I got to be very friendly with Ted Williams. He liked me a lot, and we've had great conversations during our careers and while he was alive. They were two guys that I idolized. I really loved Ted Williams, not only for his baseball skills, but for the type of man he was on and off the field. He was really my all-time idol.
So you talk about both those players, and as we talked about earlier, they're in the first All-Star game you appear in. Of course, Williams is on the same side as you in the same clubhouse. Stan Musial is on the National League side. Did you say anything to Stan Musial or to Ted Williams in that first All-Star game?
I don't remember saying anything to anybody, to be honest with you. I was too nervous, but I was on. I was the leading vote getter that year because I was leading the league, and I played the whole game. And Stan Musial hit a home run in the extra innings to beat us in Milwaukee, So I remember that part of it. And if you ever see the highlights of Stan Musial hitting a home run, I'm that little outfielder going to the fence when the ball's over. And so, I wish that, like I said, I wish I was a more of a veteran, experienced guy. But being just 20 years old and being in an All-Star game with all these great, great, great players, I wish I'd have had been able to say more and talked a little bit. But I was always thought if you're young and a rookie, sort of like a rookie, keep your mouth shut and go play baseball.
Mr. Kaline, this has been an absolutely incredible experience. Thank you so much for all the time and all the tremendous stories. This has been a real honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, this is great. Thanks for asking me. And I've been blessed to be not only a fairly good baseball player, but be in this great game for a long time.
See you later!